from deep inside your radio.
Fresh off the boat and into the French Quarter of New Orleans, and only slightly metaphorical, ladies and... No, not metaphorical at all, for once in my life. I want to thank, first of all, at the outset of the broadcast, the emailers who expressed support in the recent in the wake of the recent unpleasantness. And for those of you skeptics, let me just say, the money's going to do more good in our hands than in Rupert's. This is one of those infrequent but special editions of Le Show. Of course, they're all special, as you know, where we sit down with and talk with and hear the piano stylings of one of the piano legends around New Orleans, Louisiana, and that's coming up. But first, some other fish to fry. Dear Harry, I was in Las Vegas blogging a poker tournament, right there, you know, and regarding the world's most expensive banana, I guess you haven't spent much time in the fabulous Bellagio Hotel and Casino, where snack shop bananas cost $2.75 plus tax. So, ladies and gentlemen, that's our new total to beat for the world's most expensive banana. $2.75 at the Bellagio, you lose even before you gamble. That's cool. The bubble is getting more permeable in terms of news getting through, the same news diet being shared by all of us around the world, but still, some stories you might have missed. The United States is preparing to significantly raise its estimate of the number of nuclear weapons held by North Korea from possibly 2 to at least 8. The report would reflect a new intelligence consensus on North Korea's nuclear capabilities. It would underscore the strides North Korea has made in the last year. Intelligence officials have also broadly concluded that a separate North Korean uranium enrichment program will be operational by 2007, producing enough material for as many as an additional 6 weapons a year. These are guesswork, ladies and gentlemen, based largely on circumstantial evidence, and different intelligence agencies view them differently. So, maybe it's not true. What do you say? Australia's new fighter jets, hey, news from the coalition, we treat them well. Australia's new fighter jets are likely to have fewer stealth features than the same models being built for the U.S. military, making them more vulnerable in combat. You're welcome. Doubts about the stealth capability of the export version of the Joint Strike Fighter come in audit reports and testimony to Congress. Australia plans to pay about $11 billion for up to 100 of the yet-to-be-built jets. But there are problems with costs. Really, in a military program. Go figure. And the latest edition of the Jane's International Defense Review, an authoritative publication, reports that this program officials in the United States have indicated there will be fewer stealth features on the export version. The international version would be easier to detect by hostile radars and would consequently be more susceptible to attack. This would be a blow to the Australian government, because the Australian government has stressed that it was the stealth features of the aircraft that put it above competitors. The Australian Prime Minister defended it as a fantastic airport concept. Doesn't the word fantastic derive from the word fantasy? Yes, it does. Thanks for asking. And more news about our allies. The 4 Italian security guards kidnapped in Iraq had their personal protection weapons confiscated by American soldiers just hours before they were seized by suspected rebels, colleagues have revealed. Soldiers manning a checkpoint in one of Baghdad's most dangerous districts confiscated their 3 high-powered assault rifles and 2 pistols. Paolo Simeoni, the former leader of their security team, said the Americans claimed the Italians had flouted gun permit rules. But they issued a receipt, did the Americans, so the arms could be collected at a later date, like after they get out of a hostage deal. Good news for the Chalabi family. The tribunal that's going to try Saddam Hussein is being run by a nephew of Ahmad Chalabi. And members of the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council auditing the Iraqi Oil for Food program, the possible scandal in the Oil for Food program, is overseen by an advisor to Ahmad Chalabi. You know, busy hands. All right, the word for the week is appalled. We're all appalled. The pictures, the photographs of the that the American soldiers felt free to take as souvenirs of the cute things they were doing. Apparently, British troops were doing it too. The Army Reserve General, whose soldiers were photographed doing it, is blaming military intelligence, saying her soldiers, the detention center, were under the command of military intelligence. Once again, the spooks take the rap. And the most interesting thing about the story to me, personally, is that one of the soldiers involved said, was asked, well, what were your orders? What were you told about what not to do with prisoners, with Iraqi prisoners? And he said, well, I kept asking up the chain of command, what are our orders? What are our limits? What are the rules here? And nobody would answer. He says the first time he saw the Geneva Convention was when he was charged with violating. Of course, he's you know, coming for trial, so he may just be defending himself. But if that's true, it would suggest that although we have no policy of doing things like that, there's no way of enforcing that policy. And also, there are private contractors who are involved in the detention process who are not covered by the convention. It's I don't know if you folks saw the rundown of what soldiers were doing, these few soldiers were doing to the Iraqis, but an awful lot of it came under the heading of sexual humiliation of one form or another, which is particularly noxious, apparently, to folks in that part of the world. Now, this sounds, as I say, everybody said used the word appalling. Tony Blair is appalled. George W. Bush is appalled. General Myers is appalled. Everybody's appalled. But apparently the troops did still, in the midst of all this, observe certain limits. Nowhere in any of the reports, including the fairly fearsome ones in The New Yorker, which suggest a pattern of this activity, based on a report that's been sitting on General Myers' desk since February, which he said on George Stephanopoulos today, he still hasn't read. Despite this apparent pattern of activity of sexual humiliation, at no time did any of the Americans force any of their detainees to look at pictures of Janet Jackson's breast. So there are limits. We observe, ladies and gentlemen, some proprieties. Now, this may call for a new investigation, a new commission, but of course, the other big news in the week past was the joint appearance by President Bush and Vice President Cheney at the 9/11 Commission. It was a private meeting, no recording. Notes were taken by commission members, but their notes were confiscated for vetting by the White House before they were given back to them, if they have been given back to them. The president and the vice president spent 3 hours with the 9/11 Commission, exactly the same amount of time the president spent with Bob Woodward. So you know it's important. And there may even have been a follow-up phone conversation.
Golden Eagle.
Hey, how was it?
It was fine. Mm-hmm. It was a good visit.
It was a constructive conversation.
Yeah, a constructive conversation.
Who's that with you, Cheney?
Yes, sir. Hey, pick up the extension there, chainsaw.
Very mutually respectful.
Yeah.
You're not used to having a father and son chat with somebody else on board here.
I think we all felt that the commission experience of the joint type of testimonial was a good one
for all concerned.
For all concerned.
Well, I know, but how are you, Mr. Vice President?
Very good, Mr. President.
He's very good.
You don't need to. That's the kind of question we really don't need to double team, sir.
Got it. But yeah, the commission was respectful of the office.
Yeah.
The office looked great, so it commanded the modicum of respectability-ness. And I think, I speak for myself, but so does Dick. I think we both respected the commission and the tough job they have to do, whether per se we make it tougher for them or not.
Well, that's something for the historians.
Yeah, and of course we'll all be dead, and maybe even some of them will, too.
So you gave them nothing?
Well, not really nothing.
A sort of a modified, limited nothing.
Mm-hmm. Just some brush strokes that suggest there's a canvas underneath.
Without, giving away the store.
Or the canvas?
Yeah.
You think the commissioners were okay with you both being there together?
Well,
been a lot of yapping about that.
Mr. President, when you're smart and focused and you have the proper resolve, schedules just tend to work out that way. This is This was just one of those times.
It was historic.
We were onto something else.
Oh, right.
No doubt about it, it threw some of the more finger-pointing element of the commission back on their heels a little bit.
Well, you got two people there. You need an extra finger to do any pointing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, I mean, they didn't try to split off, have, you know, five members talk to one of you.
Oh, no.
And the other five talk to...
No. It was Onu.
Oh, my bad. No, we think this worked out well if we can get the security issues ironed out. We were talking about my next news conference being a joint one.
Didn't used to like having the number uno and the number two in the same place.
Yeah.
No, sir, it's contrary to some regulations, but as you and I both know, go.
Yeah, those are the kinds of regulations that are strangling American businesses. And again, having... You know, somebody with the calm and the calmness of Dick here by my side, I think will just make some of the more persnickety reporters think twice about, you know, trying to play word games with the language.
Well, golly, if you can bypass those regs. Oh, we've already received an offer pending the reelection to do a joint appearance at next year's Gridiron Dinner.
Yeah, he'll do the setups and I'll do the punchlines.
Now, getting back to the commission,
yeah.
You think they were satisfied?
Hey, 41, it's it's like Dick says. What was it you said?
About what?
About the commission pushing us just so far.
Yes, sir, just that we'd given in to pressure to appear before the whole commission. We had given in to pressure to visit with them for more than an hour. To do any more than that might bring into question this administration's resolve.
And we're not going to do that. Hell, the less we can bring into question, the better. Isn't that right, Chainsaw?
I'd appreciate it if you didn't playfully punch me in the ribs, sir.
Did you get into any of the being on a mission from you-know-who?
We stayed on process, procedure, a little tick-tock, very little substance.
And if they want to know what the Bible says, they can join our prayer circle. I'm not going to take taxpayers' time.
Oh, speaking of which.
Oh, right, we have a... 3 o'clock at Walnut Reed?
Mm-hmm.
Joint physical?
Schedule sometimes works out that way. You take care, Mr. President 41.
Well, you too, Dick. And you too, 43. Mars sends her love. Thanks.
One of the great treats about Jazz Fest time of year in New Orleans is the opportunity to hear people who have wonderful bands and tour the country playing with their bands, but to hear them, piano players, by their lonesome on that big 88. And last night at Piano Night, Marsha Ball was honored, inducted. Were you? Was it an actual induction ceremony? I missed that.
There was nothing like that. I think this is a very informal honor, which I love about it.
No plaque?
No, I haven't gotten the plaque or the statue or anything, but I'm on the T-shirt, which is clearly the most important thing.
That is. At Piano Night, which is a big night in the middle of Jazz Fest, and Marsha Ball joined Dr. John and Eddie Bowe as only the third honoree of Piano Night. And it just provided an opportunity for me to sit down with Marsha, whom I've admired for years, and I played the hell out of every record she's ever put out on the show, to say, come on in and let's talk a little bit and hear you play some more piano by yourself, leaving your band to... sleep late.
Yeah. I know what they're doing.
How long have you been at this?
Well, my family had piano players, generations of piano players, and my grandmother played, my aunt played on my daddy's side. My great-grandfather was a musician and a composer as well in Brobridge, Louisiana, and founded the little town band in Brobridge. And so it came down to me by birthright that I was going to be taking piano lessons as soon as I could. And it wasn't anything that I thought anything differently about. While the lessons were kiddie classicals, you know, there were all these great examples of other kinds of music alive in the house. We didn't listen to a lot of records around the house. My grandmother was playing ragtime and my aunt was playing Gershwin, and I was hearing Boogie Woogie, and the radio was playing Fats Domino and Jerry Lee Lewis. So it was always there.
And this was Vinton, Louisiana.
Vinton, Louisiana.
Which is where?
It's on the state line, Texas-Louisiana state line. It's on Old Highway 90, right before you get out of Louisiana. In fact, I was born in Orange, Texas, because there was no hospital and still is no hospital in Vinton.
Is there a casino there?
There is now.
There's
a racetrack and a casino. No hospital.
No hospital.
No doctor.
Well, they're probably a vet.
Right. That's exactly right.
Yeah, Gabe Mouth and some other people.
Well, Gabe Mouth was born in Vinton and raised in Orange. Mm. And I was born in Orange and raised in Vinton. And, that's such a rich part of the country for music. Lonnie Brooks was still called Guitar Junior. He was probably still called Lee Baker Junior when he was living down there. And Clifton was playing there.
Clifton Chenier.
And played there a lot. And Vinton is where the Orange Playboys actually lived. Joe Bonsall was from Vinton, and that was a classic Cajun band. And several of the members of the Hackberry Ramblers are from Vinton and in the past and had been. And
can you hear, are there like roadhouses where you can hear this music there?
That state line, see, when I was growing up especially, it was the wall. It was the Berlin Wall of alcohol, you know, and everybody from Texas wanted to get across the line and could. And this is also from many generations. Daddy, when he was a kid, counted 40 nightclubs, honky-tonks, places between the river, including one called the Riverboat on the Louisiana side in the Sabine River, between there and Lake Charles, because it was always that way. It was always looser on the Louisiana side.
And who would you go see?
Well, a lot of times at the Circle Club, there'd be a Cajun band downstairs for what we call the old folks, and then a rock and roll band upstairs. And so it might be the Hackberry Ramblers or somebody like that downstairs, and then the Boogie Kings or J.T. Richard and the Blues Kings or Bobby Page and Riff Raff or the Champagne Brothers from over in Houston. Bighorn band, always Bighorn bands upstairs.
Mm. And when did you first get on stage and play have people pay money to see you?
Well, I didn't sing through any of that time. And I went to college at LSU and met a folk singer friend, and she recruited me to sing harmony. And so really I was like, 17, almost 18 and in college before I even tried it. And not long after that, because it really was the cusp. That was the falling off place in Louisiana, the year that everything changed, like 1967, and when things changed and when I discovered the counterculture and found the bad crowd, I fell right into it.
And haven't left it since.
Right, no. And the first thing you know, I'm trying out for a band, and I'm in a band. I was 18.
And you had classical piano training, right?
Well, kiddie classicals, not anything that...
Oh, not in college?
No, I was not studying music in college.
What were you studying?
I wasn't, but...
What were you telling people you were studying?
I was reading and writing mostly, and it's what I'd probably do again or more of. I would be a literature major, probably.
Mm-hmm. Did you get a degree?
No.
You dropped out?
I dropped out.
You did get it with a bad crowd.
I did, and I didn't stay in school. I know.
Yeah, and look at you now.
I know. And I think, many people that I know go back to school as adults, and I think that's a wonderful thing. And they always do great. They're always 4.0 students, and I just have this terrible suspicion that I wouldn't do any better this time around, that I'm no more disciplined than I was then.
Well, you have an amazing discipline because you are on the road. What do you do on, like, 300 nights a year, or is that?
Well, no, we're down. There was a time probably when we peaked out at probably a couple hundred nights a year, but we're down to probably 150. Mm. At this point.
That's still pretty heavy touring.
It's about half the time.
Yeah.
We're out there. But, God, it's the joy of my life. I love it. You know, it's freedom and fulfillment and...
love.
Love. And because I've really managed to have a family, too, mm-hmm. and a good life that way, I'm real fortunate.
Could you play a little something for us just to get these ivories awakened?
Mm-hmm. Or me.
Or you.
My spoon and fork, and when it's time to cut my steak, I make sure my knife is sharp. And if I want to hang a picture, I reach for a hammer and nail. And if it's time to clean the floor, I get out my mop and pail. I don't like to waste my time. I make sure I've got the right tool for the job. I want a fan that keeps me cool at night. A man that always loves me right.
Yeah.
Good morning.
Whose song is that?
Mine.
That's brilliant.
Thank you.
You don't write enough.
Oh, yeah, I do. You know, I don't believe not every song needs to be performed out there. It's one of my list songs. I love list songs.
Yeah, but it's also got that sly kind of metaphorical thing that old blues songs have, you know. I need another hot dog in my roll, that kind of thing. It's got that.
Yeah, let me play with your poodle.
Yeah, exactly. There aren't a lot of women doing what you do. Is that true?
No, I think that is true. And yet, and there are. There are many that are known regionally and sometimes even locally who are incredibly talented and you know, especially like piano players out on the West Coast, Wendy DeWitt, Sue Palmer, and, you know, many, many people I'm not going to remember to name. You know, practically in every community there's somebody that's...
But, I mean, when we were at piano night and you saw who came up to the stage, it was, what, 99% guys?
Yes, yes. And I've been really fortunate to be able to bridge that line. And you know, there, Carol Fran was there a few years ago. Hatta Brooks was there. Katie Webster would have been right in the middle of that and should have been the star of that, I think. And, you know, she was a huge inspiration to me. Two-fisted mama.
Who else? Who else was an inspiration to you?
Well, on piano, we almost have to get back to the guys again, you know, back to the obvious, you know, Fats Domino and Jerry Lee, and then Professor Longhair and his down the line from him. And, of course, Alan Toussaint, my songwriting, if I owe to anyone, I owe to Alan Toussaint. I mean, a lot of times I write a song and I think, man, you know, he's going to sue.
Or you've channeled him.
Yeah, which you could do a lot worse.
Yeah.
You know, and then, of course, Dr. John and Booker. And
did you see Booker when he was, you saw him when he was playing?
I did see him. We played some together here in New Orleans at the Maple Leaf and at Tipitina's.
On that terrible old piano at the Maple Leaf?
At both places had pianos. They're famous and revered pianos, but...
I guess that's all changed since you travel with an electric keyboard now.
I do play a keyboard, and you know, last night at the piano night was a perfect example of why, because you just cannot hear or be heard over a big band,
yeah.
And, you know, playing right behind you, you know. That's great, but, you know, that's why a keyboard, you just crank it. Took a while for keyboard technology to catch up, you know. Electric guitars were... many varied and very efficient before they managed to make a keyboard that sounded like a piano at all.
Maybe it's because there wasn't a Les Paul, you know, doing all that innovating as a player.
Right, there really wasn't. And in fact, one of the first quality pickups out there was a Helpenstil. And part of the reason that it was developed was that Charlie Helpenstil was a piano player.
In addition to being able to hear yourself, you don't get that experience of playing that wide variety of crappy pianos at clubs around the country.
Exactly, with your back to the audience because the piano's facing the back wall. You know, a lot of why I play with my legs crossed is because, you know, I was always put in these incredibly visually compromised positions with a piano.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And for many years, we carried a spinet with whatever pickup was on the market at the time, plus microphones and everything else. And that thing got stripped down to the keyboard and the soundboard, pretty much. The pedals were even knocked off. And we replaced the bottom because we just scraped it along the ground. We replaced it a couple times with wide oak planks. But I'd have to reach inside and hit the bars that instead of the pedals, you know.
Because there weren't any pedals.
No, there weren't any pedals. I just have to reach in and hit the bars to sustain.
So now you skip them.
Yeah.
You are famous for, among other things, your cross-legged, I can't say stance because you're not standing.
Right.
But you're a famously tall woman who swings those legs.
Whose legs don't fit under the keyboard.
Is that it?
Right.
And one thing you can't help but notice, because it is sort of hypnotic, is you don't appear to be swinging your legs in time to the music you're playing.
Well,
what's up with that?
It's kind of like a drummer, you know. Not everything is on the one and the three.
Ah.
You know, if you watch, you know, one of my feet is keeping the beat, and the other is keeping the counter to that beat.
Ah.
So,
So you're doing polyrhythms with your legs.
Yes, there's a method to, to that madness. And at one point, probably I'll put a, when I go into the one-person band thing, I'll be ready to go.
Have you found, just to go back to that, that being a woman in this profession for a moment, I sort of admire the fact that you never talk about problems that that brings up, but there must be some.
You know, for a long time, I've always said that I didn't find that success was a gender situation. That if you worked hard and were focused and were lucky and had some ability and, you know, used your brains and ran a business and did all the things that successful people do, then you would be successful in the business. But that's not necessarily true. And I figured out a while back that, for one thing, a lot of women went before me and opened a lot of doors. And everything that everybody suffered in the business, from Bessie Smith and all, everybody, every kind of discrimination, you know, people like Bessie Smith were the biggest selling recording artists in their day. Mm. More than Robert Johnson, Bessie Smith would be the father of the blues.
But she didn't make a deal with the devil.
So. No, that's right. It's as someone pointed out recently, it's the story.
That's it.
You know, you got to have the story. But they opened a lot of doors all the way through, and including, you know, the young ones now, Susan Tedeschi, Bonnie Raitt, you know, everybody that has a bit of success, headlines a show successfully, makes it easy for a woman to get booked to headline the next show.
But now you still play a lot of clubs where there's a lot of let's say there's a lot of raucousness.
Oh, well, that never bothered me.
In the audience. You just dig right in.
Yeah, no, that's never been a problem.
Yeah.
No, that's another thing I think I learned from Katie Webster. You know, she showed up in the club in her little church dress, you know, maybe a white suit with a red blouse with a big bow at the neck. And boy, before you know it, she's out there doing the black bottom, you know, she's low down on the front of the stage. We're grown-ups here.
Mm-hmm. Can handle ourselves.
Yes, yeah. We're all grown-ups. Yeah. And, you know, I wanted a career. I came up in the rock and roll days when people were dying at 27, left and right. Mm. You know, we lost a whole generation of our stars before they were 30 years old. And I really did want to live a long life and play music if I could. So I tried to figure out how to walk that line. And I was lucky in timing, too. We could watch them make those mistakes.
Yeah. Can I request another tune?
Yes.
You did. This was another one you did the other night, which I loved hearing solo, which was House of Love.
Well, okay. Now, this song, I didn't write this. John Lee Sanders, a guy who grew up in Jackson, Mississippi, and then Monroe, Louisiana, and now lives in Oakland, a great player, piano and saxophone, wrote this song. Mm. Foreclosed on the House of Love. We got married too young too soon. No money down, no payments till June. I had you believe. Thank you. free.
With Marcia Ball moments from now here on the show, but it's time for the apologies of the week. Can't miss those. Francisco Elson, the Denver Nuggets reserve rookie center, apologized this week for calling Kevin Garnett of the Minnesota Timberwolves gay after Garnett hit him in the groin during a playoff game. "I realized my comments were insensitive and they were out of character for me," said the center in a written statement. It's also out of character, I think, for him to issue written statements. The gag email that National Guard Major General George W. Key forwarded to friends last week lampooned the upcoming Democratic National Convention and U.S. Senator Edward Kennedy. But this week, the laughter had ended and Keefe was issuing a statement of regret. He heads the Massachusetts National Guard. He forwarded an email entitled Democratic National Committee Convention Official Program. Among the gag events were an opening flag-burning ceremony, an anti-war concert by Barbara Streisand, a gay marriage ceremony, a reenactment of John Kerry's fake medal toss, a multiple gay marriage ceremony, threesomes mixed and same-sex, and a Free Saddam pet rally. Six times, there was an entry on the agenda that read, "Ted Kennedy proposes a toast." Keefe, 65, was unavailable for an interview. But he issued a statement that read, "While I did not compose this email, I did receive and subsequently forwarded to several acquaintances. On reflection, I regret that action." Don't mess with humor if you're not. Restaurants are apologizing left and right this week, ladies and gentlemen. Police believe teenage pranksters are hacking into the wireless frequency of a Burger King drive-thru speaker to tell potential customers they're too fat for fast food. Offenders are reportedly trapping into the wireless frequency of the restaurant in Troy, Michigan. Police believe the culprits are watching and broadcasting from close range. Management of the fast food restaurant are reportedly trying to change the radio frequency. Meanwhile, Burger King franchise owner Tony Versace issued the following statement. We apologize to our customers who've been insulted by the use of the drive-thru speaker. When Nancy King saw a McDonald's restaurant flying the U.S. flag at half-staff in honor of the company's late chief executive, she protested. She's an Air Force veteran, and others quickly complained. The fast food giant quickly admitted the mistake in flag etiquette and asked its restaurant operators to raise the stars and stripes to full height. A McDonald's official said the company erred when it asked its restaurant operators to fly flags at half-staff to honor James Cantalupo, who died April 19th. He was the head of McDonald's. He died of a heart attack. You know the rest. We apologize for the mistake and plan to take steps to rectify it, said McDonald's spokesman. And Sui Imama and Isabel Leota received an apology for free meals. Gift certificates for free meals to Chuck-A-Rama in Salt Lake City. We did not provide them with the kind of experience they expected when they came to our restaurant, and we sincerely apologize to them, says Chuck-A-Rama Chief Executive Dwayne Moss. One of the women made several trips to the carving station, and the general manager grew increasingly concerned about not having enough roast beef for other patrons. When Amama went up for the 12th, for his, sorry, he's a man, went up for his 12th slice, the manager told him he could not have any more meat. The couple were offended by the manager's accent and asked for a refund. Chuck-A-Rama said the manager has always offered a buffet-style menu and as such has always reserved the right to limit the quantity of food selections. Barbara Walters has apologized for an ABC News weekend promo for Friday's 2020 dealing with adoption. Viewers objected to the promo, which attempted to tap into the reality show craze by saying that five couples would compete to adopt a 16-year-old's baby. You know what the bad word was? Compete, said Barbara Walters. A promo promotes to make you want to watch. Promos sometimes get a little heated, and we made a mistake, she said. And a University of Massachusetts at Amherst graduate student is apologizing to Pat Tillman's family. Pat Tillman, the former NFL football player who went into the military and was killed. Rene Gonzalez had written a column for the campus paper saying the football player turned soldier who died in combat in Afghanistan wasn't a hero but a G.I. Joe guy who got what was coming to him. Gonzalez said in an email to a Boston TV station he was trying to say Tillman's celebrity had factored into his being labeled a hero. He admits he tried to prove his point in an insensitive way and that the article wasn't worth publishing. The school's president issued a statement calling Gonzalez's column, quote, a disgusting, arrogant, and intellectually immature attack on Tillman. Well, if you can't be intellectually immature before you graduate. Yes, right. The paper ran a letter to readers saying the column didn't express the paper's views. What column does? Oh, too many questions. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. More with Marshall Ball moments from now here on the show. People think you're, at least I did, I sure did for a long time, that you are a New Orleanian or that you are in this scene or of this scene, but you're from another place. I mean, you're from Vinton, but you live in Austin. You're part of that scene.
Right.
Do you, when you're home, off the road, do you do a lot of gigs in Austin?
You know, I have in the past. I mean, I've really been a part of the Austin scene since practically I moved there. My first band in Austin in 1972 was a band that was a country band at the in the time of the progressive country scare, as Steve Humboldt called it, when that was what was really going on in that town. And for and I was lucky that, you know, I fell in with another group of musicians and that band established me there. So it was a good time, too, because as that scene developed and more bands came to town, you know, it really became a, kind of a crowded scene. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, I was kind of there on the ground floor, which was nice. But it's odd about my place in that community because, you know, there was the country scene and I was part of that. And then while the spotlight was really on that, when Jerry Jeff Walker and Asleep at the Wheel and Willie Nelson and my band and other bands like mine were getting all the press, there was this wonderful thing bubbling under the surface of the Austin scene, which was the blues. And bands like Lou Ann Barton's band and the Fabulous Thunderbirds and Angela Straley's band and W.C. Clark and Stevie playing with the Cobras and then with his own band, they were all playing these little clubs, but they weren't getting the press the way the progressive country thing was. And you could tell it was going to break, and it broke big in about, I guess, 75 is when things started moving along. And so everything, it was great. I mean, we always had good clubs, and our clubs kind of modeled themselves in many ways, whether consciously or not, on Bill Graham's productions at the Fillmore, which meant that they would put an old hero of the blues or something, Mance Lipscomb or Robert Shaw or Freddie King, who wasn't old at the time but who was the blues man and practically the patron saint of the Armadillo World Headquarters. Mm. I mean, on the same show with a little progressive country band like my band, or which was called Frida and the Fire Dogs.
Were you Frida?
I was Frida. Or you know, or Asleep at the Wheel. You know, we'd be opening for Muddy Waters and Cliff and Chenier and everybody. So,
well, the whole booking philosophy of the Fillmore, because I was around San Francisco in the kind of the early days of that, and to you're going to see Miles Davis and Muddy Waters and the Rolling Stones on one bill,
right?
Or you know,
right, B.B. King and Big Brother and the Holding Company.
That's right, yeah. And you're gonna you're gonna come for the whole evening. You'll get into whatever state of mind you have to get to, but people listened, were open to all that stuff. And
well, they were open. They were given that too. They weren't. They were open to it, yes, but you know, they would. They were fed it too in a way by people who were visionary about it, and you know, those are the people that I appreciate so much.
Business has changed.
Oh, you know, yes it, and no. What's weird about it is now we're that old band, you know. Now we're the old coots they're putting on the show with those young hotshots. So there it goes.
But so you will, when you're home, you don't rest. You do the clubs in Austin.
Some. I don't play in Austin all that much anymore. The scene changes. All the scenes change, you know, and there's more alternative. Also, I've always had this kind of awkward relationship with Austin. I'm a piano player in a guitar town. You know, as much as I've been inspired by the songwriting and as much as I feel like I have a place among the songwriters in Austin, and that's one of the things for which they're most famous and justifiably. And, you know, I've been inspired by the Lubbock guys, the Flatlanders, you know, Jimmy Gilmore and Butch Hancock and Joe Ely and all the great songwriters there. I'm not a jangly guitar player. My songs generally don't start with the strumming of an acoustic guitar, which about two-thirds of the songs on KGSR do.
Yeah.
So it's always been this kind of awkward relationship. You know, they'll ask me if I'll put a song on a compilation record for a fundraiser for something, but could you do something that's not about Louisiana? You know? It doesn't matter if Joe Ely does something about Lubbock.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
But it's that state line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
Are you working on a new record?
Not actively. I'm writing, and I've had some fun writing recently. I just had a chance to write with Freebo and Jim Photoglow, who's a great, he's based in Nashville, and he's a wonderful singer, and, you know, one way to write a really pretty song is to write with somebody with a really pretty voice, and he does.
So, it's a great name.
Yeah, I know. It's Greek, Photoglow.
Photoglow. Wow.
Yeah. So I'm writing some, and Stephen Bruton, who produced this last record on Alligator for me, is, now that he's not acting in movies, he was in the Alamo recently, calls me up now and says, okay, you know, what are we going to do next?
Well, they don't blame him for that. They blame Eisner.
Yeah, that's right. You know, they lost. It's, you know.
Would you like to play something else of your choice?
Well, let me think. I like to dance, and I like to sing. Starts out hot. She put the crawfish in the pot. She makes a roux so dark and sweet. Mama's cooking what I like to eat. Mama's cooking best red beans. Mama's cooking best you ever seen. Mama's cooking sweet potato. People ask me why I don't get fat. I say, I guess it's 'cause I dance like that. I eat as much as I can hold. Go out and do the sudden cold. There's lots of people in the world today. They're trying to drink their cares away. But if they knew how happy they could be, they'd be
things that struck me when I first met you is among all the musicians I know, you're one of the brainiest.
Ah, well, they're out there. You know, they're they may not be letting you know it, but
yeah.
There's a lot of brains. There's a lot of readers.
Yeah,
and that's what I am. I like to read, and there's a lot of readers out there. But
is the road good for reading?
Yeah, you know, that's the best thing. You know, the funny thing about that is that most or many of the writers I know are very into music, almost to the extent that we almost can't talk to one another because they want to talk about music and I want to talk about books.
Mm.
A lot of the people that I know who are musicians actually read a lot more than
what do I think?
Yeah. And it's true. You know, we're in trucks,
yeah.
We're on buses, you know, yeah. And
you can read on the bus?
I can. Oh, thank goodness. I couldn't have survived.
Yeah.
And, you know, we don't travel in a bus, which is a good thing in a way because once you get a bus, then you're just watching cable TV again. I just mainly sit in the shotgun seat and with a map on my lap. And
Oh, you're the navigator.
And read.
And what do you read? What's your...
A little bit of everything. I like good fiction. And I read lately, you know, I'm reading quite a bit of politics. I'm reading Woodward's book, of course, right now. Isn't everyone. And I read history because being a college dropout, you know, I missed a lot of important stuff. Also, I have a tendency to get so frustrated with current events that I tune them out. And then I go back and read them 10 years later as history.
When passions have cooled.
That's right.
So you're just catching up with the Persian Gulf War now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I am. I'm reading War in the Time of Peace, or I just, you know, I'm kind of halfway through that. And then, of course, other things at this point. History's happening so fast.
Yes, it is.
That it's hard to keep up.
Marcia, I could sit here and converse with you for hours, but I know you got a million gigs to do and a lot of people to see.
We have to eat again real soon.
We do have to eat real soon. If I could ask you to play one thing, just an instrumental to go out on, would you be willing to do that?
Yes.
And people can watch for you. You're traveling around the country. You're as great a companion and a conversationalist and friend as you are on the radio. You're an amazing person to see on stage, so everybody should go do that.
Well, thank you very much. This is great. I love
My
your
pleasure.
Show.
Thank you.
I'm glad to be on it.
Once again, my thanks to Marcia Ball, my thanks to Wes and all the folks at Piety Street Studios, the Studio of the Stars, my thanks to Bob Dunn at WWL-TV here in New Orleans, all for making today's Le Show possible. That is going to put a cap on this edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz, on your computer whenever you want it, around the world via the internet at two different locations, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, live and archived, and now as available as a free download at audible.com/listshow. And it would be just like everybody being appalled if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you? Alrighty. Thank you very much. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. Le Show playlists usually available at harryshearer.com. The interval music on today's broadcast by Tom McDermott. From the French Quarter of New Orleans, Louisiana, thanks for listening. And you're invited to join us next week at this same time. Le Show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.